Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined by Anlu Kieva. Anlu, how are you doing on this fine Friday afternoon?
Hello, Nicholas. I'm doing quite well, thank you. The day has had good manners so far, so doing well, thanks.
That's very good to hear. And joining us for the first time on the show is new colleague of ours, Ricardo Teixeira. Ricardo, very welcome on the show. You are an expert in all things defense related, so we look forward to hearing your wisdom on these topics.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Very good to have you with us. All right, let us start with the news of today. So we are going to talk about a bunch of defense topics, drawing from Ricardo's knowledge and experience in that field. But before we get to those, let's just talk a little bit about the ongoing political drama that has broken out in the past week. So we talked earlier this week in the show about how President Ramaphosa, in a session in Soweto where he, as far as I can tell, basically just shouted at all the ANC councillors for not performing well enough, decided that he was going to praise the DA, specifically with regards to the fact that DA municipalities tend to get most of the clean audits. And this has caused quite a commotion within the ANC, with lots of very brave anonymous sources speaking to News 24, calling essentially for his removal. So Ramaphosa sort of kind of slightly tried to walk back some of these comments. He said that, well, you know, the DA may get clean audits, but the ANC actually transforms lives. He said, if you were to talk to our people in Philippi, in Delft, in Langa, they will tell you that those clean audits are not resulting in the transformation of their lives where they live, because there are enormous challenges. This is where DA municipalities must learn a lot from ANC municipalities. Ramaphosa said the ANC could learn from DA municipalities on clean audits, but the DA could also learn from ANC municipalities on transformation. So, Andu, perhaps we can get into that a bit just now on the topic of transformation and real transformation. But this has caused a firestorm of bitterness within the ANC. Some who have accused Ramaphosa of campaigning for the DA and sabotaging the ANC's campaign. And even some who are not brave enough to go on the record about this, but as I said, have been talking to media publications anonymously, saying that they believed that Ramaphosa basically should be kicked out of the party for this, for, as they say, de-campaigning. So apparently Ramaphosa doesn't seem to be too stressed about this. He said that three times apparently he's been alleged to have decided he wanted to leave the leadership of the ANC, but comrades have stopped him, according to a source in the ANC. He may be strategically planning his exit and will not allow an item to debate his performance at the National General Council. Right now, the ANC is begging him not to go so he can say whatever he wants. He does not fear being recalled. This is what a source inside the party said. There was also some comments from Snooki Zikalala, who basically said what Ramaphosa is really trying to say here is just that our councillors must provide good services and ensure clean audits, and you know, this isn't an advert for the DA. Anlu, if ever there was a sign that the ANC is feeling a little bit insecure going into the local government elections, I think this whole story is it. Firstly, I mean, I understand to some degree why people in the party are upset about this. This is not how you want to, you know, be talking a year out from the next local government elections. But at the same time, what he said was not a lie. It's not particularly contestable. It is true that the DA tends to get better audit results in municipalities. And the response, it seems, so far from within the ANC has been to kind of put fingers in ears and say, no, we're not going to hear you. You're being mean. Stop it. What's your take on all the politics of this?
Well, I was somewhat confused, actually, because what Ramaphosa said is that the DA's clean audits didn't translate into better service delivery. So my immediate response was, okay, so they had clean audits, but it didn't translate into service delivery. You didn't have clean audits, and it didn't translate into service delivery. well done. So like kind of two negatives in this situation really does not translate into a positive. And I don't think his message got lost in translation, which was one of the excuses that he used. I think he very clearly, when I went back and listened to it, said that we can't always stay at the bottom. And that's quite clear in very direct terms that their municipalities are not performing. And he's backtracking and saying that the DA should learn from them. What the DA can learn from them is their transformation. Which, yeah, well, I agree with him in some sense, but only if he means fake transformation. And this is the clearest indication for me, well, in my opinion, of where the ANC's priorities lie. Because what he's saying is that from a compliance point of view, that the DA municipalities are compliant, but from a transformation point of view, the ANC municipalities are compliant, which really just indicates that they don't care about the constitutional mandate that the municipalities and the public service has, which is to, well, be meritocratic and that they should be operated professionally. And these municipalities just care about transformation at the end of the day. They right. don't.
You know, so when it comes to spending the money properly on the poor and on government services, accounting for it all, you know, the DA is good at that. But when it comes to racial bean counting, we're really good at that. That's essentially what he's saying, which is just, you know, as exactly. you say, so sort of twisted.
Yeah, no, exactly. They care about ticking those boxes. They don't actually care about the service delivery. And this is where I disagree with him, is that there's no difference between compliance and service delivery. You can't, these two concepts are so interconnected that you rarely have a situation where you have the one and not the other. If you look, for example, at the unemployment figures, the Western Cape has the lowest unemployment rate. It's at like 19.6 or something. So if you take 10 people out of Langa, let's say you have two of them that's given up on looking for a job. But if you take 10 people out of the Northwestern province, which has like 52-53% unemployment, then you have five people who've given up on looking for a job. That's kind of a very clear indication of what's happening. And if you just go and look at the actual Auditor General's report, you'll see that almost 60% of the clean audits are Western Cape municipalities. So I really, yeah, there's no use for him to backtrack. And I agree with you had yesterday on John Endres, who's obviously the CEO for the Institute of Race Relations. And I really liked when he also said that as the pressure increases, we'll just continue seeing these mistakes on the behalf of the ANC coming into the media and into the light. And we've seen it also when he went on with the National Dialogue and made that lovely comment of rather post the question, which he's been doing quite a lot recently. He's been asking questions and people seem to be getting upset. But the question he asked was that we should ask ourselves why some people live in poverty and others live lavishly, or whatever the direct words was that he used. So, yeah, I think his political capital is running out and we can just, it's very clear how out of touch he really is.
So, Ricardo, when I initially talked about this story earlier in the week, I kind of made fun of Ramaphosa for the way he sort of framed this. When he talked about ensuring accountability from politicians and, you know, when he was putting pressure on the councillors to, you know, do their jobs properly and make sure that the municipalities are working and such, he was almost talking like some kind of outside commentator who, you know, doesn't have the power to actually affect anything. And perhaps the reason why he was doing that is because even this relatively mild criticism, you know, which is that the DA gets more clean audits, has provoked calls within his own party to basically have him thrown out, which suggests perhaps that the ANC is, shall we say, resistant to any kind of change, even from their leader, who is still their best electoral asset, even though he is a depreciated asset from, you know, back in 2019. What's your take on this whole story?
I found it very interesting, and I like what Anlu said about, you know, he's been asking a lot of questions, because what I got from that engagement was someone who's in charge of the country, but his job is not to run municipalities. His job is to lead. And he was sitting in a room with roughly 4,000 councillors and saying, hey, guys, why is it when we look at the best-run municipalities, they're all DA municipalities? He was putting a rhetorical question to them, to the room. And very much like what Gwede said, which, man, I wish I could frame a clip and just walk past it and watch it every day, where he said, we've got a lot of singing councils, but capacity dololo. Like, he said openly, you know, none of you here can tell me I'm wrong. And none of you here can say you're doing your job, because none of your municipalities are those best run municipalities. They're all DA ones. So maybe we need to see what they're doing and have a look, a good hard look in the mirror and say, what are we trying to do here? You know, that the ANC has been in charge now for 31 years. And I've always said the end of a revolution is worst for the revolutionary. And that they're always still tied to that identity. But it's now been 31 years and they still don't see themselves as, you know, we're the country, the party that's been running the country for 31 years. They still see themselves as, we ended above them. Okay, you did. And that was wonderful. And it was one of the best things that happened in human history. But it's now 31 years later. What else have you done?
No, exactly. You know, and even when the ANC does sort of bring up its legitimate successes that it did have in government, you know, rolling out X many number of houses, in creating the social security net, expanding access to electricity and water, almost all of those achievements, in fact, I think probably every single one, is sort of front-loaded in that period between 94 and about kind of 2003-ish.
Until about 2004, yeah, or until about then.
Yeah, and then we had from sort of 2004 to 2007, we had the years of pretty good economic growth. We kind of were reaching around 5%, partly driven by commodity prices, but also because the ANC policy wasn't quite as toxic. And, you know, it's this kind of, you know, living on the fumes of faded glory. And every year, it's like someone who is an alcoholic or a drunk at a bar, who used to be a sort of star athlete. And they keep telling you about the glory days. And every time you're like, okay, dude, but like, you know, what are you doing this weekend? And he's like, oh, let me tell you, in 1986, I ran the fastest lap at this time. And you say, okay, that's great. But what are you doing this weekend? And the ANC doesn't seem to have any answer to that question. And even when they start looking around and at others who are perhaps, you know, achieving some things, in this case, the clean audits, the sort of response is, how dare you talk up the opposition? You're a traitor.
If I can think of a perfect analogy, the ANC is very much like Steven Seagal, where in the 90s, they were the darling, you know, everybody was obsessed with them. But now you look back and you go, well, all they've really done is like mess up since then. And they've got all these allegations against them and there's a lot of problems. And now they're also weirdly obsessed with Russia all of a sudden. Like it's...
It's actually remarkably
similar. It's shockingly similar. And there's a lot of... When you look at Steven Seagal as well, you know, we see a lot of bellies on those councillors, man. A lot of people that look comfortable with this.
Hey, look, as a man of size myself, I do have some sympathy for the large bellies of councillors. But, Andrew, do you have any additional thoughts before we move on?
Well, just something that keeps coming up in the back of my mind is this idea that no man can serve two masters. And I think it just is so clear with the ANC as well, where you really... they can't have both economic growth and functioning municipalities and opportunities within these municipalities and have fake transformation. There's just no way that can work. And as long as they think it can work, we'll sit in exactly the same position we are, which is one where things like ghost employees, which has been in the news, is not surprising at all.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about that. There's research being done by the Treasury, so this is not some outside opposition group suggesting that government may be spending annually at least just under 4 billion rand on employees who do not exist, which is an absolutely crazy number. But anyway, we'll get to that, I think, next week, because that is not going to be going away anytime soon. Okay, let us move on to talking a little bit about South Africa's defense. It's been an eventful period in South Africa's defense history. The number of scandals, the number of disasters have been sort of piling up, and it kind of seems like the system is really creaking at the moment. But a sign of this is that South Africa's Department of Defense ordered or signed a contract with Danel, which is this, you know, South African defense manufacturing military technology company. Signed a contract with them in 2007, paying 7.7 billion rand to get new Badger infantry fighting vehicles to replace the old Rattles. These have still not been delivered, which Ricardo, we were talking before the show and you said, you know, this is dating from when you were still quite young today.
I was in grade four. I was 9 years old and I am now 28. I'm married and I'm sitting here and not a single vehicle has been delivered.
It is like such a sort of bonkers statistic. And can you just explain what this actually means? Because I sort of read the story and I assumed at first, oh, this means that, you know, that like they just haven't built a factory or something for it. But it's actually worse than that, isn't it? You were explaining the details of this to me before the show.
So Project Hoofeisted was initiated in the early 2000s, but it was kind of announced and the tendering process was around 2007. But the project itself goes back to late 90s, early 2000s, where they decided, you know, the Rattle infantry fighter vehicles, they were designed and built in the mid-70s for the border war. And now, you know, the border war was over, there were a lot of lessons learned, and based on that, they felt, you know, we need to move forward with a new mechanized infantry fighting vehicle. It's going to be the backbone of our conventional capability, but we need something a little bit more modern for the future threats. And that therein already is one of the problems, because when we were looking at the threats that, or when you look at the threats that South Africa was facing at around that time, there was no conventional threat, but there was a larger regional instability and insurgency threat. So a lot of planners argue that they should never have started with the infantry fighter vehicles as the replacement. They should have started with the logistical vehicles. There were other projects then called Vistula and Sepula, which were supposed to replace the Mamba and Casper fleet. Note those are also still in service, dating back to the early 70s and early 80s. And then also the logistics truck. And those three would have been a common chassis. And then after that, they would have gone on to conventional. But for some reason, they decided we're going to start on conventional, the most complicated, the most expensive. And we're going to start, and initially they decided, you know, we're not going to replace the entire fleet of 1,100 Rattles. We're going to partially replace it with about three battalions worth, so 264 vehicles. And the process went on, and they selected the design that was being put forward by what is now called ADGM, at the time was LMT Engineering, which was in partnership with a Finnish company called Patria for the AMD, which then became the Badger. But how the project was set up was that there were certain deliverables and timelines where when certain criteria was met, such as, you know, the drivetrains have been done, you've assembled them, you know, you can now get the next part of the funding to allocate for gearboxes. And then, you know, as soon as that is done and you've assembled those, you get the next part for the wheels, the hull, the turret, and so forth. But to date, you know, a lot of those deliverables were signed off on in order for them to then order the next part of, well, the next supply of parts to assemble. But at no point did they start assembling. And even to date, they have not finalized the base design, or what you call the base development of the vehicle. Basically the hull of the vehicle and all of its components, such as the engine, the gearbox, the drivetrain, the fire control system, the fire suppression system, the aircon, the radios, all of that. That production baseline variant has still not been completed. And what they've got is enough parts sitting in a storage warehouse at the NAL Land Systems to maybe assemble 100, 120 vehicles, depending on what you've got. But again, not a single vehicle has been assembled. They've got 26 hulls, I believe, where they've built the hull, never put on the turret, and they're kind of sitting there, and then they have the stockpile of parts and just not much else to show for it. And they've spent 7.7 billion rand.
That's an impressive amount of bad spending in order to get a bunch of parts in a warehouse. I mean, you know, this is clearly sort of a management failure above everything else. But, you know, it does also kind of strike me that this is still attempting to fulfill a contract, as you said, you know, back in 2007. Isn't this, I mean, this is essentially a modernization program, right? Isn't it kind of already out of date?
So kind of what was supposed to happen after the arms deal, there was a decision made that in the 90s when they went upon the arms deal, that the army is in the best state out of the three branches because it has the most modern equipment at the time because the Rathals came in the early 80s, the Roy Cuts came in the early 90s, the Oryxes came in. That, okay, we're not going to focus on the army here. We're going to go Air Force and Navy, and as soon as those projects are done, there's going to be a series of projects initiated to then commence with the army, and that's where Hoofasted came in. At that point, the frigates were coming into service, the new submarines, the Gripens, the A109 helicopters from Leonardo, and then we were going to start with the army. So it was part of that process of which is supposed to be a gradual modernization, a constant cycle of improvement instead of what we've ended up with, which has been about 20 years of stagnation.
And that and this was the arms deal and sort of all the associated drama that came with it was part of all this.
Which we can discuss in the next episode.
I think many people much older than us have spent all, entire careers discussing the disaster that was the arms deal. But, it does strike me. I mean, right now we're seeing all over the world just these incredible rapid advancements being driven by technology and in war fighting. And so it seems like even if all of these projects were completed on time, we'd have to sort of almost go through another round of modernization. You know, next time we're going to be facing... let's say we're facing insurgents in southern Mozambique linked to ISIS who are using drones to attack our infantry fighting vehicles. You know, without the electronic warfare components, without the sort of right design for that, you know, you're just going to be putting yourselves in danger and at a disadvantage. So, sort of like decades behind.
And that is part of the problem now because the army for the last 10 years since the 2015 Defense Review has been talking about arresting the decline. And it's at a point where, okay, this conversation needs to stop because you're not going to arrest it. You need to leapfrog ahead. And instead of trying to complete and finish projects that are almost 20 years old, that are already outdated, and maybe you don't need them anymore, perhaps it's time to put the final nail in the coffin, take funding, and try and look ahead and be like, okay, we didn't need these for the last 20 years. Are we going to need them for the next 20 years? No, likely not. So perhaps it's time to look at something else, like, say, replacing our helicopter fleet or a new fleet of light tactical vehicles that are easily deployable.
Nicholas, I just want to say, I get so upset when we constantly, across the entire government, we hear these, like, arresting the decline or they want to build capacity in the future. But it's just stagnation all across. And the part that upsets me most is the idea that they keep on saying South Africans are resilient. Through all of this, we're supposed to be resilient. And yes, we are. But I mean, why do we have to be resilient? Why can we not be actually a force to reckon with? Why do we need to be resilient? Why do we need to just deal with it as it is? Very upsetting.
Yeah. Fynbos cactuses, these are resilient plants. They're also generally not considered lush, healthy, beautiful things that you put on at a flower show. You don't want to be a cactus.
Yeah.
You want to be like some kind of beautiful orchid or something, or some sort of great tropical plant that grows massively and is filled with life. Danelle's, of course, another state-owned enterprise. And this is just another addition to the long list of state-owned enterprises that have not succeeded. And, you know, unfortunately, we know the reasons in so many cases: politicization, BE, corruption, mismanagement, the breakdown of meritocracy, misallocation of funds. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, perhaps just as a point to your cactus analogy that you just provided, I mentioned this a couple episodes ago when I was on, and this is your point, Ricardo, which is that Pretoria is like, we don't have at our advantage that we can use spectacle as a tool. I think you said as a tool for statecraft, which I thought was a very, very good point. If we look, Nicholas, as you mentioned, at the actual state of these the entire defense department, we have, for example, the Auditor General, which has on many occasions said that there's flaws, serious flaws in the financial management of the Department of Defense. If we look at something like the Navy's actual recorded hours that they've spent on the sea, I think it's something absurd. Like, Ricardo, maybe you'll know better, but it's something like at least six or sevenfold less.
So the targeted goal was dropped from 20,000 a few years ago down to 12,000 and then 10,000. We are struggling now to even hit 3,000. And just for comparison's sake, on the Air Force as well, the Air Force is barely hitting 2,000 flight hours. Earlier this week, a high-ranking general in Brazil's Air Force testified to their parliament because their target is about 100, I believe it's 120,000 hours a year, and they're only hitting 80,000 now, and he's sounding the alarm about it to parliament. We can't even hit 2,000.
Yes.
We're sitting at a point where our Air Force inventory, on a good day, which is not once a month, it's maybe once a quarter, on a good day, we've got 8% aircraft availability. In the month of July, of the, I believe there's 56 PC-7 trainer aircraft. I might be incorrect on that number, but there's around about that amount of turboprop trainer aircraft. In the month of July, not one flew. Like, not a single one.
Bonkers stuff. So let's pick... Go ahead, Anna.
There's quite, like, for a pilot, never mind a fighter pilot or somebody who's actually in the defense.
A pilot.
You need hours. You need hours.
Just to learn.
License. Exactly.
What are you guys talking about? It's not like it's very complicated. Anyone can fly a plane, especially a fighter.
It's not like riding a bike. It's like riding a tricycle, apparently. Oh, sorry, it's like riding a unicycle. You know, there's balance. I mean,
learn it in an afternoon.
If we talk about helicopters, right now the Rattle fleet, the Royfalk fleet, they, you know, everybody, I don't know where this comes from, but people think that there are dozens of Royfalk. There were 12. The fleet was reduced to 11. At the current moment, there are 4 that can take off. And I use the word take off very loosely. But there is not a single person in 16 Squadron that is current on that aircraft because they haven't been able to fly them consistently to maintain their currency. Not even the officer commanding. And when I received a photo recently from a member of the unit, and when I asked him, like, hey, man, you know, these are serviceable. Can they take off? And he said, yes. I said, okay. Does the GPS work? And he said, yes. I said, does the radio work? And he said, sometimes. Oh. And I said, okay. Does the targeting system and the avionics, are they reliable? And he said, you're asking a very difficult question there. So that just comes to the nature of it, is that most of what we've got, because these projects have been delayed, and I like what Andre said here in the comments, is about supply chain. The logistics of the Air Force has been completely eroded to the point where they can't sustain anything.
Yeah, no, exactly. And one of the first lessons I think you learn when you're learning about anything to do with militaries is how key logistics are.
Yeah.
You can have all the shiny tanks and equipment and parades and everything you want, but if you can't supply food, medical equipment, ammunition to the people who need it, it's all just for show. But let's jump onto our next topic here. Ricardo, you were just attending an event with the South African National Defense Union. We were raising some issues connected to the deployment in the DRC, which, as we know, ended in disaster with our soldiers essentially being taken prisoner by the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. One of the reasons for that is presumably because they didn't have support from those Royfalk attack helicopters, which you said are sort of not working, kind of a bit working, some of them, but, you know, not properly working.
Sometimes.
Some bits are working, but not enough to actually deploy them, it seems. What did you learn at this press conference?
So the main grievance that is occurring right now between the troops, well, there's a couple of them. There's a grievance about the leadership, the grievance that, you know, there was a failure in planning and in assessing what capabilities were needed, because the government seems to be saying, you know, mission accomplished, we achieved peace, it was a great peacekeeping mission. But it really wasn't a peacekeeping mission. It was a peace enforcement mission, which had an offensive mandate. And the soldiers are saying, hey, you sent us out there to go fight a war, and you didn't equip us properly, you didn't plan accordingly, and you're also now not paying us correctly. I mean, some of those troops were there from December 2023 until they came back in May. That's about 18 months, of which they spent about 5 months confined to their bases, in essence, under prisoner of war status, where They were allowed to wear their uniforms. They were not allowed to have weapons. They were not allowed to leave their base. And they were surrounded by M23 24/7 with weapons pointed at them. And now they're coming back, and the department's like, yeah, yeah, here's your allowances, finish the clock. Now, one of the big things is ahead of the deployment, they were supposed to negotiate what the allowances were going to be. They didn't. And according to the union, the rates for the allowances that the Defense Force then used are rates that were set in 2000. So they're 25 years old. So these are rates that are like, I mean, one of them was like $1.22 a day. One of them was 20 rand 77 cents a day. So the big problem now is that the Defense Force is refusing to acknowledge the claims and refusing to go to the Military Bargaining Council. But the union, and I have their claims here that they sent forth to the Defense Force, annexure D in the documents that we were given today. And they demand for all of the troops the following allowances. Danger allowance, 1,500 rand per day. Special danger allowance, 2,500 rand per day. Standby allowance, 1,000 rand per day. Deprivation allowance, 1,500 rand per day. International obligation standard danger allowance, 1,500 a day. And the compensation amount of $1,428 paid by SADC per member per month be matched by the government and paid to each deployed member for their time deployed. That amounts to, just on the ones that were listed in RANDs, the danger, special danger, standby, deprivation, and the what they call the international obligation standard danger allowance. Those allowances on their own total to about 8,000 Rand per day per soldier, or for those that were deployed from May 2024 till they returned. That's about 2.8 million Rand a year. And for those that were there from December 2023, that's about 4.2 million Rand. Now, this again, this is just their starting point for the negotiation, because the Defense Force isn't just open to negotiating and isn't coming to the table. But the soldiers basically feel, you know, you sent us out there, you hung us out to dry, and now you're giving us cents on the dollar and telling us to shut up and be happy with it. And what they're openly saying is that, hey, this is not fair. This is not according to proper procedure. This is not according to the standards at which they're supposed to be compensated in comparison to what the other troops from Tanzania and Malawi were compensated. And they, you know, considering what they had to go through, they feel they should be fairly compensated to some extent. And this includes the troops that were wounded and the ones that were killed as well, the compensation to their families.
So, I mean, this is just kind of, I think, for me, underlines the some of the meritocracy stuff once again. You know, you can quibble, you can say, oh, well, the union's demanding too much here. They're kind of pushing it on some of these issues. You know, are those rates really fair? Whatever. But I think that's kind of, for me, besides the point. What the point is here is that this is reflecting a very genuine outrage, which is, as Ricardo said, that, you know, these soldiers were hung out to dry and they want something back for it. And they know they're going to have to fight for it, because unfortunately our armed forces have been, as have so many of our government departments, have been turned into institutions where political allegiance is the most important thing to get ahead. You'd be a, you know, good cadre of the movement. And people who are committed, people who perform their jobs, people who are, go through difficult things, not so important experience. We don't really care about that. It's if you treat your employees badly, is it any wonder that you have difficulty attracting talent? And, you know, this is obviously worse in the Defense Force because you're getting shot at. But across all spheres of government, you know, we see this where, who aspires to go and be a civil servant unless you probably don't have that many other options? You probably want to be in the private sector because, you know, there's, even though the pay might not necessarily initially be as much, the environment's probably going to be better. You know, if you're a high performer, you can actually get promoted based on that, not based on who you know.
There's no risk of a random mortar landing in front of you and blowing your legs off.
Yes, that too.
And sorry, Nicholas, the point here is also, now we end up with a bunch of people in our military who kind of don't want to be there. Who are not at all, they just have no other option than to be there because that's kind of what they have to do, which is really not inspiring any trust or any enthusiasm, really. I'm not sure if that's what we are looking for. Something that caught my attention too, and perhaps you'd be able to, there might be something that I'm misunderstanding, Ricardo, but so the SANDF soldiers who were deployed received something like 34,000 Rand, but there was actually a lot more allocated to them. Is that something that, can we point the finger to actual accountability and actual transparency issues here?
Right.
Or
there is a big, big problem in terms of accounting and accountability in the Defence Force, because the Defence Force says, yes, we've paid you guys. But they said, okay, this was not an agreed-upon amount. At no point have we negotiated. But again, the military is refusing any sort of transparency as to how they decided on the allowances and how they were paid. Because again, right, there's this amount here of 1,428. Yeah. There's an amount of $1,428. Exactly.
They should have done this beforehand, not...
Yes, and they were required to by procedure. Yeah, according to procedure, this was something that was supposed to be agreed upon by the bargaining council before the deployment. That didn't happen. But this is an amount of $1,428 paid by SADC, which is supposed to be matched by the government per soldier per month. Now, from that, you know, some supposed to cover your rations, your ammunition, equipment, and all of that. But what's left over is supposed to then be paid to the soldier. We don't know where any of that money went. And SANDF is not open to any sort of transparency to say, okay, yes, that number that we was, that amount we were supposed to match with has gone here. That is not happening. And there is a claim going around amongst soldiers on some of their pay slips, their IRP-5s, that shows a taxable allowance of about 108,000 Rand a month. Now, they don't know what that amount is for. And it would be very easy for SANDF to come forward and say, okay, this amount is for this. But SANDF has refused to just openly say, okay, this line item is this. There is just no transparency whatsoever, full stonewalling. And this has driven the union to the point where they've had to come forward and do a press statement and put all these documents, all the annexures for the disagreements, put it forward, including the MOU, which isn't signed, and say, hey, you know, like, meet us halfway, because the Defence Force is just refusing to do so.
Yes, once again, just wonderful money going into that lovely black hole we have somewhere in our country. Just, I don't know, it's, yeah.
I think I'm going to lose my mind if we keep talking about this. So, Ricardo, any final thoughts to close off the show today?
Oh, man. To any men and women in uniform watching this, I thank you for your sacrifices and for your service. And I hope that one day we can sort out the problems in our Defence Force and that we can, as a country, start moving forward and start moving towards a professional civil service.
Yeah. No, that's the underlying message on all of this. We will keep advocating for this kind of stuff going forward. But thank you to everyone for listening today. We hope you found the show interesting. Thank you, Anlu and Ricardo, for your time today. And we will see you all next week on the Daily Friend Show. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.
Bye.